Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case we have for you today is part two of the West Virginia University co-eds, Merritt Malarik and Karen Farrell. So, Court, are you ready to dive into the rest of the co-ed murders?
Let's do it.
Before we start, I want to say if you haven't listened to last week's episode, stop what you're doing, go back and listen. You do not want to miss anything on this case. So 4 months after confessing to the murders of Merritt Malarik and Karen Farrell, Eugene Paul Clausen started to say that he made the entire thing up.
Why would he do that?
He thought he could escape a charge in New Jersey by confessing to this one. You want to know how he came up with the story?
Might as well hear it.
Well, he said he read about it in crime magazines, which kind of makes sense because there are about five different magazines. And you know me, I try to get my hands on them, but I couldn't. But luckily, I did find every single one of them scanned and in an online document. So David Solomon wasn't buying it. He said that Eugene was attempting to run around and he already confessed to things that only the killer would know. The defense actually claimed Eugene was the product of his troubled life and a clever fantasist. So on April 9th, 1976, Eugene Paul Clausen was indicted on two counts of first-degree murder by a Monongalia County grand jury. Eugene was incarcerated in New Jersey and waived extradition. 3 weeks later, he was sentenced to 15 years in prison for his conviction in New Jersey, which the legal proceedings actually delayed his extradition to West Virginia for over a month. So on May 18th, 1976, Trooper D.M. Shade said in a note that Eugene began to doubt on his own recollection of events. What I have of Shade's notes says this.
We brought him out in the car and Officer McCade advised him of his Miranda rights, as we always do. At approximately 1:10 p.m., as we were driving west on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, Clausen voluntarily brought up the co-ed murders, that he did not know whether he had committed the crime or not now, and that he couldn't just see himself doing that. At approximately 1:20 p.m., he asked me, Trooper Shade, if he had possession of the machete, and I advised him that I had, and then he turned around. And then he stated to me, quote, my brother turned it over to you, end quote. And I advised him that he was. He then stated, quote, I told you he was a prick, end quote. And then he said, quote, I bet you did not find any blood on it, end quote. And I asked him how he knew this, or I wasn't going to say one way or the other. He then stated, quote, I know you didn't, because the night I washed it off with gasoline, end quote. He then stated that he liked it at Rahway because they did not have any bars over the windows or guards that carried any guns or clubs. That he had his own room and they showed X-rated movies. He said he was going to change his story because he wanted to go back to Rahway. He did not want to stay in West Virginia. He did not want to stay in a West Virginia prison. He said he was not going to plead guilty because he did not like Solomon and he was not going to make it easy for him. He had seen a Cadillac and started talking about the 1964 white Cadillac that he had in 1970 and that he wished that he had kept it. Well, that was a whole lot.
Right. I didn't add all of it because It's a lot, but you get the picture. He is trying to get back to New Jersey where he could have the easy life in prison.
So on Wednesday, May 19th, 1976, Eugene was arraigned in Monongalia County Circuit Court. He was assigned attorney L. Edward Friend to be his public defender. On May 25th, after 5 months of saying he was guilty, Eugene pled not guilty to the murders of Merritt Malarik and Karen Farrell. His bond was actually denied and his trial date was set for June 28th. Friend said that it would take him and his partner, Michael Tomasky, several weeks to prepare. So after this, Solomon said he wanted Eugene to undergo a pre-trial examination at the West Virginia University Hospital. In a newspaper article, it said that Circuit Court Judge Marvin R. Kigger granted Solomon's request. The prosecutor said the examination will begin today at 2 p.m. Court-appointed attorney Friend also requested an examination of Clausen and requested a discovery motion be entered in the case.
Troopers Shade and McCabe transported Eugene to West Virginia University Hospital on May 26th. So on the following day, May 27th, Eugene was examined by psychiatrist Donald C. Carter. 2 days later, Dr. Carter determined that Eugene Clausen was not competent to stay in trial and recommended further treatment with another re-evaluation. In a letter, he said, "Dear sir, I have, in a psychiatric examination, studied the above, captioned 36-year-old white single man on the 26th of May 1976. From the standpoint of the question posed by the court to render an opinion as an option as to the mental competency to stand trial for murder, it is my professional opinion that Mr. Clausen is not competent to stand trial at this time, nor will he be in the near future. It is conceivable that with intensive and long-term psychiatric treatment, his mental condition may improve. However, chances are 50-50 that he very probably will not improve to the extent. My psychiatric diagnosis are paranoid state with very probable underlying paranoid schizophrenia, and my second diagnosis is Klinefelter syndrome, hormone treated by maintenance medication."
So what exactly is Klinefelter syndrome?
So according to the Cleveland Clinic, it's a genetic condition in which people assigned male at birth have an additional X chromosome, like XXY. Symptoms may include breast growth, infertility, osteoporosis, and learning difficulties. Treatments usually involved physical and emotional therapy, as well as hormone replacement. On June 1st, Friend filed a motion for a continuance, basically saying that he wanted Eugene to be taken from the West Virginia University Hospital and transferred to the Weston State Hospital, better known as the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum.
So out of all the places, why did he want to send him to Weston?
He wanted him sent there for a period of time, basically just 20 days, unless extended to a period, not to extend 40 days for observation and further examination, in order to determine if he was competent to stand trial or not, which due to staffing shortages, it caused his stay at Weston to be extended. So the original date of the trial came and went. Eugene stayed in the Weston State Hospital until July 12th when it became apparent that there was a lack of personnel.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
On July 21st, Eugene was examined, and I mean thoroughly examined, by psychiatrist R.O. Pletcher and psychiatrist Robert Bell. From the paperwork, from the examination on July 21, 1976, said Klein is a 36-year-old white male who has an effeminate attitude and is rather soft-spoken and seems to be relatively at ease and not under undue emotional stress. He attained the 10th grade of school and said he was merely pushed along, having taken special education for 3 grades, from the 4th grade to the 7th. He also stated he was a slow learner. The diagnosis, schizophrenia, schizoaffective depressed in an individual who has basically psychopathic personality. Prognosis, guarded. Recommendations, providing his mental function remains unchanged. I believe he can stand trial at the designated time. So on August 18th, Dr. Carter examined Eugene again and said,
"Dear Mr. Solomon, I have examined the above captioned 36-year-old man who currently is in jail waiting determination of his competency to stand trial for murder. My examination is at this time reveals that Mr. Clausen is in my personal opinion now competent to stand trial. My opinion as to whether or not he was competent at the time of the murder of the co-eds is also formulated, and it is my professional opinion that Mr. Clausen was mentally competent at that time. Sincerely, Donald C. Carter, M.D." So on August 26, 1976, Judge Kiger ruled that the court finds that the defendant understands the nature and consequences of the charges pending against him, and that he could participate in any hearing or trial that may be held hereafter. On October 7th, Friend filed a motion for a change of venue, starting at an oversaturation of negative media coverage in the Morgantown area, which would typically make it hard to find a good jury. Judge Kiger considered it, but determined that the passions and anger of the community had cooled down during the 6 years. He said the knife's edge of averse publicity had dulled.
So what did he mean?
Well, he was declining the request to move the trial somewhere else, which I get, but at the same time, I mean, we know how big a trial was in Beckley here recently, and we both wondered why the trial was still held in town. I guess it was kind of the same reasoning here. They thought everything died down, when in all honesty, it just relit the fire of everyone's obsession in the case. So during the lead up to trial, Eugene stayed incarcerated in the Mongegalia County Jail. The trial was scheduled to begin on October 26, the state of West Virginia versus Eugene Paul Clausen. Picking the jury moved quicker than anyone thought. By 1:30 p.m., the courtroom was filled with media and the curious public. From what I can tell, Solomon didn't hold back. He went straight to the point in his opening statement. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I will now open the evil window of the death and relate to you the facts and circumstances the state of West Virginia will rely upon to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Eugene Paul Clausen is guilty of the premeditated and willful murder of 2 young girls on Sunday night, January 18, 1970, in the lonely and silent woods of Mongegalia County. And we will further open this window and show you that the defendant on that fateful night did deliberately and willfully murder those 2 beautiful co-eds by decapitating them after subjecting them to abuse and indignities beyond description and belief." L. Edward Friend took a more, I guess you could say, reserved approach. Court, you want to read what he said?
He said, "Very much of what Mr. Solomon said to you is true. Mr. Clausen is not what we would consider, what you and I consider, a completely adjusted person. He had problems since he was in grade school in Point Marion, and I imagine at some time the prosecutor will bring out some of the problems he's been in. He's been in and out of jail. It isn't the first time he's been in trouble. It isn't the first time he's been sitting in jail. The temptations will be, once you've read the horrible, degrading acts described by my client as written down and recorded, to want to punish him for something, and I don't care about that. But remember, we're here on trial of murders, separate the crime from what this person, as I've described him, says in these statements. I ask you, without arguing the case in closing, to listen to the evidence on behalf of my client. Listen to it. I ask you to be skeptical of evidence that violates your common sense. And again, ask you, don't make up your mind until you've heard everything, both the prosecutor's case and the defense.
Court, do you remember in part one, the friends they ended up leaving the movie with?
Yeah, Clarence and Paulette.
So Clarence and Paulette took the stand and told the jury what they could remember from that night. Their stories really didn't change from 1970. They said they met them at the Metropolitan Theater, walked them to Willie Street, then saw both girls drive by in a white car. Neither saw Merritt or Karen get in the car. They both also didn't get a good look at the driver.
So they really couldn't tell if it was Eugene or not.
No, that's the thing. All they could really tell is that it was a white male. While going through his round of questions, Friend asked Paulette if she could remember giving a statement in 1970, basically to the effect that the driver looked to be older than what Eugene would have been at the time.
What did she say?
Well, in her statement, she said that the man appeared to be older, that he could possibly been in his 40s. She could neither confirm or deny that she said that. So the next morning, on January 19th, Chief of the Morgantown Police, Benny Palmer, testified that news of the missing girls reached him by a telephone call from Westchester Hall, where the girls lived. He said after that, an all-points bulletin was sent out via teletype, which, for those of you who have no idea what a teletype is, Court, do you want to tell them?
Sure. A teletype is a printing device kind of resembling a typewriter that is used to send and receive telephonic signals through various communication channels.
So they sent a teletype to the West Virginia State Police. After this, John Fox with the West Virginia State Police recalled how he photographed the location where the girls were found. He talked about a set of photos he took. Now, there was some issues over the pictures. Some was added into evidence and some wasn't.
How come?
They were too graphic. They were worried it would outweigh anything in the trial. And I mean, to this day, you can find none of the images of the girls anywhere. I mean, I've seen a few of the autopsy pictures and they have literally been so censored, it's insane. Like, you see their clothes, that's it.
Dr. Milton Hales, who performed the autopsy on Merritt, took the stand next. He explained the process, then Solomon asked the questions of visible injuries and how they may have been inflicted. Dr. Hale said that he felt it would have taken several blows from a heavy, sharp instrument to sever the cervical vertebrae. He asked if this could have been achieved with a machete. He said that it could. However, he did say that he also thought a weapon could have been an axe or hatchet-like implement. The question of sexual assault came up, and Dr. Hale testified that he was unable to say if the girls were assaulted.
Day two of the trial started with no issues. They talked about where the girls were found, then later in the day, Dr. Suzuki, who performed the autopsy on Karen, just like Dr. Hale's, said that he felt like the decapitation was the result of heavy blows with the sharp implement. However, he was unable to say whether the implement was a machete or another cutting tool. When everything turned to Eugene and his alleged actions on the night the girls were murdered, everything kind of started to spark in the room.
What do you mean?
Well, they got into the two on-the-record confessions given by Eugene. Kind of midway through the day, Eugene, his attorneys, and the prosecution met in Judge Kiger's chambers. And I know what you're thinking, why would they go into the chambers? Well, they went to review the audio of his second confession. It was actually questioned if the two confessions would be evidence, which this actually started a screaming match between the prosecution and defense. Why? I'm honestly not too sure. During the afternoon session, Solomon cited five witnesses, including Trooper Shade, Major Hall, and Officer McCabe. After this, Solomon and Fred went at it again over alleged discrepancies between the audio recordings and the transcript from the February 17th confession. And Court, I have what Fred said in the document. Care to read it?
Sure. Quote, the confession shows the defendant wanted an attorney, but didn't get one. There are dozens of places where the tape and transcriptions differ, end quote. Solomon said, quote, the transcription is reasonably accurate and correct, and the defense has had copies for weeks. The tape is available to them and has been. They have not made themselves available to it. They are basing their objections on their own assertions, end quote.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
So after this, Fran made a motion to have all of the references to explicit acts between Eugene and the girls be omitted from the record, as there was no evidence corroborating the assertions existed. This motion was overruled by Judge Kiger. After all of the arguments, Judge Kiger made his decision. And Court, you already know I found the transcript, so you know I'm going to have you read it. Are you ready?
Yeah. From witnesses in the submission made in chambers with regard to this confession, the court believes it is sufficient to warrant submission to the jury. The statement appears to have voluntarily made, and from that standpoint is admissible. After this, day two of the trial came to an end.
Day three happened on October 28th, 1976, and it was devoted to recordings of the confessions made by Eugene. Trooper Shade actually read all 73 pages of the first confession. During the afternoon session, they played the recorded version of the second confession. All of the info from the confession is in part one. If you haven't yet listened to it, stop what you're doing and go listen to it. Day four took place on October 29th, 1976. Which this day is the biggest obstacle for prosecution, trying to put Eugene at the Point Marion site where he claimed to dispose of both heads and weapons, which this was kind of hard to do.
I wonder why.
Well, if you remember, there were no bones found or even the skulls at the location he said he disposed of them. So after talking about trying to find the heads and the entire search of the location, the prosecution rested. Later that day, Eugene's defense team had their turn. So they called Eugene's former superintendent from the warehouse factory, Francis J. Foley, to the stand. He brought company records which showed that Eugene worked on January 18th, 1970, and several days after. After this, the trial ended its first week, which they promised that Eugene would take the stand on Monday, November 1st. And on Monday, November 1st, he did just that. While on the stand, Eugene stuck to his story, the one that he fabricated his confession in a misguided attempt. He wanted to try to gain freedom in New Jersey and thought that confessing to these murders would work.
I have no clue why he would think that that would work.
I mean, it wouldn't. Like, I've never heard of anything like this in any case, have you?
Mm-mm.
So, back to the reason he confessed. You may be shocked, but I did track down the transcript. Court, will you do the honors?
Sure. I made the confession because I've been sitting in jail for 2 years. In December 1975, I read 2 articles in a magazine. If I can make them believe I committed the crime, I could later prove my innocence. All the facts I used in the confession were in that book.
So after this, they did something that I love. They handed out copies of the magazines to the jury. Then Eugene went on to read the 7-page articles on the murders. To save you time, we won't read them for you, but you can find them on our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.
Now, Assistant Prosecutor Mike Margot did object to this. Judge Kiger advised the jury that the contents of the article may not be accurate. However, it was presented as the alleged source for Eugene's confession. He then talked about how he was working at the warehouse in Philadelphia on January 18, 1970, and that he never came to Morgantown. The defense created a strategy where they would highlight inconsistencies in Eugene's 2 confessions. After this, 3 officers took the stand.
Preston Gooden said her coat was still on her and very neat. Her pinstripe slacks were very neat. Her blouse was fully buttoned and neat. Everything down to a pack of cigarettes tucked into the waist of her slacks.
Friends said, you have investigated rapes and murders. Did you find any evidence of sexual molestation?
I did not. Major R.M. Hall said, the burial site was not clear from his explanations. I tried to get him to go into more minute detail.
Friend, did he try to evade you?
Yes, he did.
How did he react?
He detested it because I wanted more detail. Sergeant L. Harold also said that he observed no sign of sexual assault. On November 2nd, there wasn't a trial due to the fact it was election day. Governor Moore got the boot and Rockefeller became the new governor. From what I can tell, he really didn't get involved in the case, which is really nice. The trial continued on Wednesday morning. This was considered a semi-boring day from what I can gather. There was questioning of Merritt's ex-boyfriend. The defense rested its case just 10 minutes after it started. The prosecution called over 40 witnesses to the stand. The defense called 6.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
At 11 a.m. on Tuesday, November 4th, 1976, the closing statements began. In defense of Eugene Clausen, attorneys Tomasky and Friend stressed the similarities between the detective magazine and the distances in time. Friend actually cited 27 instances where the 2 confessions from Eugene in the magazine matched up. He said that it was all but impossible for Eugene to have left Philadelphia during the afternoon on January 18, 1970, driven across the state, complete the murders during the timeline given, which would have taken him 8 hours to drive. However, as today, it only takes about 4 hours and 35 minutes to make it from Philadelphia to Morgantown. Which, in all honesty, that is one hell of a drive. I've actually made it before.
I can only imagine. Because, like, I Googled it from where we are today, and it's only, like, 5 hours. And I'm like, huh, we may have to go one day.
I mean, we can go. I mean, it's just, it's a hell of a drive.
I can only imagine. From the transcript of Friend, he said, quote, "The state says that Eugene Clausen did it, and it's now trying to fit him into the crime. They want to put the square peg into a round hole," end quote. Mike Margot stressed that the facts and evidence which the state presented, Eugene's confessions, the machete they found at his brother's house, and the hairs from two different people in Point Marion.
So we done been through all this, and it's just not talking about hairs.
So they did find two types of hairs that seemed to be cut instead of pulled from a head. Which, I promise, I'm saving it for, like, later, so just stay with me. Which, in a dramatic moment from which he would actually show a grief, Margot held up several what people called graphic photos of Merritt and Karen, saying that they once had been young, healthy girls.
Do we even know what the photographs were?
Sadly, no. I'm guessing it would either have to be the bodies at the crime scene or the pictures from the autopsy. So, with this, Margot pointed a finger at Eugene and called him a liar and said that he recounted his confession for the simplest reasons.
Margot said, quote, "He is lying because he doesn't want to go to jail. He's a sly one. The defense spoke of a 1973 article where he supposedly first learned about the murders, but they produced no article from 1973, end quote.
And, you know, as ironic as it is, Margot would end up regretting saying this.
What's that?
Here's the thing. There is a detective magazine from 1973. It's called The Police. It was released in February of 1973, and it did have an identical opening paragraph to the article from 1975. David Solomon fired the final storm of 21 additional points described by Eugene, which did not appear in the 1975 detective magazine. He talked about the machete, the missing bra and underwear, the locations where he tossed the girl's possessions, the hairs, and Eugene's description of the two individuals walking with Karen and Marin on the night they were killed.
Eugene said that the male and female he saw on Wally were African American. In an article, it said, quote, "The point that the friends of the victims who were walking with them that night were black was brought out. It was a point in the confession made by Clausen when he was asked," end quote. The final round of dramatics, Solomon turned and pointed to Eugene. Quote, "I charge you, Eugene Paul Clausen, with the brutal murders and condemn you for your evil act and your moral deep baseness," end quote. After that, the jury went to decide Eugene Paul Clausen's fate.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
At 2:45 p.m. on November 15th, 1976, the jury returned with their verdict. They found Eugene Paul Clausen guilty of first-degree murder, along with no mercy in the verdict. His attorney wasted no time in filing an appeal. Friend said that the omission of the graphic photos into evidence had been inflammatory and swayed the jury against Eugene. What happened next surprised everyone. Judge Kiger overruled the motion. He changed it to life in prison with no parole. He would begin to serve his time in West Virginia after he serves his time in New Jersey. Friend made it known that he planned to fight the verdict. On July 8, 1977, he filed an official appeal to the West Virginia Supreme Court in Charleston, West Virginia. In the appeal, he stated that in addition to the graphic photos, the denial of a change of venue had given Eugene a trial by an impartial jury. On Monday, November 7, 1977, the West Virginia Supreme Court voted to review the conviction of Eugene. And of course, the court didn't move swiftly. I mean, why would it? On September 3, 1980, the West Virginia Supreme Court issued its ruling. Court, I have it in the document. Can you read it?
State of West Virginia, at a regular term of the Supreme Court of Appeals, continued and held at Charleston, Kanawha County, on the 23rd day of September, 1980. The following order was made and entered to it. The State of West Virginia, plaintiff below, defendant in error, Eugene Paul Clausen, defendant below, plaintiff in error, upon a writ of error in supersedious to a judgment of the Circuit Court of Monongalia County rendered on the 15th day of November 1987. The court having maturely considered the transcript of the record herein and the argument and briefs of counsel thereon, its reason stated in writing and filed with the record that there is an error in said judgment. It is therefore considered and ordered by the court that the judgment of the Circuit Court of Monongalia County rendered on the 15th day of November 1978 be, and the same is hereby set aside, reversed, and annulled. The verdict of the jury is set aside, and the new trial is awarded to the plaintiff in error, Eugene Paul Clausen, is remanded to the Circuit Court of the Monongalia County for further proceedings to be had therein. According to the principles stated and directions given in written opening aforesaid, and further according to law, all of which is ordered to be certified to the Circuit Court of Monongalia County. The syllabus appoint adjusted prefixed to the written opinion prepared by Justice Miller was concurred in by Chief Justice Neely, Justice Kaplan, Harshbarger, and McGraw.
In July of 1971, the Monongalia County Circuit Court ruled in favor of a change of venue. Basically, the letter said that all parties agreed on Randolph County as the location of the trial. In this new trial, the state was prohibited to enter into evidence any images of Merritt and Karen post-mortem. Keep in mind, Eugene is still serving an 18-year sentence in New Jersey, and for this trial, he would have to make another trip to West Virginia. His retrial was originally scheduled for July 20th, 1981, which, just like before, the circumstances intervened once again. On July 16th, the state of West Virginia was forced to ask for a new continuance when something new appeared. Corporal Shade was informed that the location in Point Marion, Pennsylvania, you know, where Eugene said he disposed of the heads, gun, and where they found the hairs, had been at some point used as a dumping area for garbage. A routine check of residents in the area revealed that Donna Martin was a licensed beautician and had cut the hairs of her neighbors. So, like, the only way to settle all of this was by the process of elimination. Police found the clients of Donna Martin and asked them to look at the hair. I mean, Donna herself told law enforcement that she could remember about the color and the length of the hairs that were found. Which, to some people, this seems like it would be hard, but to me and you, we both have a background in cutting hair, and in all honesty, if it's a regular client, you're able to tell who it is. So one by one, people start to be eliminated from this list. And you may find this crazy like I did, but Donna told law enforcement that she burned before it was taken into the Conn school garbage dump. And I don't know about you, Court, but when I was typing this, I literally smelled burning hair and I literally gagged because it is the worst smell ever.
It truly is.
It ended up being ruled that the hair could be presented to the jury just like it was in 1976. In early October, the prep for the trial was almost done. Much of the same evidence and witnesses would be presented. Friend was asked back to represent Eugene. However, Thomas Newbra and Robert Stone were selected to present. The judge over the trial was Jack Newsom. The one thing that was different about this trial was the presence of media. Judge Newsom did what he could to accommodate, but he drew the line when it came to distractions. He said, "I don't care how many cameras you have, as long as you don't use any more artificial light than we already have in this courtroom." Which court? I know us, and I know we would have been glued to the TV back then like we were to our phones a few weeks ago for a 3-week trial. Just imagine if we had TVs, endless snacks, everything, we would be stuck to our TV.
True.
On October 26, 1981, which was 5 years from the start of the first trial, the retrial began. After the retrial, Eugene Paul Clausen was found guilty, but this time was granted mercy.
By this time, he served his time in New Jersey and was sent to the West Virginia State Penitentiary in Moundsville, West Virginia. When the state penitentiary closed, Eugene was transferred to the Mount Olive Correctional Facility.
Eugene Paul Clausen passed away in 2009. To this day, the heads of Karen Farrell and Merib Malarik have never been found. New leads still come up to this day and they are still being investigated.
It's been 55 years since the senseless murders of Karen Farrell and Merib Malarik. And to us, we are still not sure if Eugene Paul Clausen was actually guilty of committing these murders or not.
We'll be back next week with a brand new case. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find good West Virginia true crime podcasts.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube. All at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.